And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week of the 4th of July is a terrific time to pay tribute to one of America's greatest inventions, its national parks. It's a good time to think about our national parks because our legacy is being hit hard by fiscal restraints. And despite the fact that parks continue to serve the public's need for recreation and recreation, this love affair is taking its toll on trails, visitor centers, rangers, and roads. So today, we focus your attention on the Grand National Parks as we turn our attention to a variety of parks that tell America's story when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I'm a park person. Whether it be the local park we go to for a quick getaway, one of the thousands of state parks that hold the living systems intact, and certainly the great monuments to the best that humans can envision as tribute to life and wonder, our national parks. This past 4th of July weekend, literally millions of people visited national parks. And on an annual basis, almost every single U.S. citizen visits a park, statistically, with a population estimated at 295,734,134 as of today, July 2005. Over the past year, 276,900,000 visits were tallied. That boils down to 1,960 visits per day in each of the country's 387 park units. Of course, that's the way statistics see it. But some of America's greatest parks see some phenomenal numbers. When I served as artist-in-residence in Yellowstone National Park, each day during the summer, close to 40,000 visitors were in that park. It's a phenomenal love affair we have. The legacy of national parks reads like a list of bestsellers: Big Bend, Badlands, Bandelier, Blue Ridge Parkway, Bryce. And that's just some of the parks starting with B: Yellowstone, Yosemite, Crater Lake, Canyonlands, Chaco. You could spend the rest of your life exploring our national parks and end up a better person for it. There are currently 387 national park units, and they preserve and share the story of America so amazingly. We have the national parks, but we also have national rivers and seashores. We have our history told in national historic sites and historical parks, as well as battlefields and monuments. There is so much that is ours, and that means yours. These are our national parks, and following the news, we are going to revisit some of the parks we visited here on the Wildside News. So get ready to hear from some of America's greatest American storytellers following this week's summary of Nature News. And now, the news. From Anchorage, Alaska, comes the following story. Melting ice could destroy polar bear populations within the next century, according to an international panel of experts. If the current trend continues, the warming climate in the Arctic will erode sea ice, forcing the giant white bears to hunt seals from shore or onto smaller and smaller floes, the World Conservation Union warned last week. The group's outgoing chairman, biologist Scott Schleiby, whose job it is to oversee management of polar bears in Alaska for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, spoke clearly. "This is the first time that we have evaluated the plight of polar bears with respect to climate change, and we found that they were vulnerable to extinction. Scientists have observed that sea ice is losing its thickness, melted faster in spring and reformed later in fall, and that stretches near Alaska have become ice-free during the last three summers." And now to today's leading story. Leaders from the United States, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Russia, otherwise known as the G8, are holed up at the Glen Eagles Lodge in Elkdrottar, Scotland, to set goals and agendas for the world of tomorrow. Accompanying them, albeit at quite a safe distance, is the world's globalization response team, otherwise known as protesters. The dance between grandeur and street theater is, if nothing else, amusing. However, both sides will admit that the substance of their presence is serious. Prime Minister Tony Blair, the host of the event, had hoped to convince President Bush to join the consensus of world leaders who have pushed since Kyoto for mandatory limits on greenhouse gas emissions in order to force the world's industrialized nations to reduce global warming. The Bush administration, standing tall against any mandatory measures, has forced the weakening of the G8 mandate once again, eliminating mandatory limits and replacing them with goals, which are to be achieved through voluntary means. In a confusing mixed signal, the Bush administration last week touted its dedication to address the global warming issue by taking a strong stand for the creation of clean energy sources, favorite of which, for the administration, amazingly ends up as nuclear power, the new clean energy source. Needless to say, the expected outcome at the global level once again downplays the significance, much less the existence of, global warming. And in California, as we speak, California State Assembly's 11-member Utilities and Commerce Committee is voting on the popular Million Solar Roofs Bill, SB1, during a regularly scheduled hearing. If passed by the committee, it will go on to the General Assembly for a vote in August. If passed there, it will give California the claim for the largest solar bill ever passed. In an effort to reduce the effects of global warming, free the state's economy from the folly of global oil pricing, and create a new energy economy, Governor Schwarzenegger has shown a strong determination to get this bill passed. Generally supported by majorities from both sides of the political fence, the Million Solar Roofs Initiative requires all new home construction to include the option of solar and to provide a $2.38 tax rebate for every watt of solar energy installed. The bill, which is expected to pass by a significant margin, will establish a solid commitment with real economic clout to empower the emergence of a new energy future. Despite Americans' strong support for the Endangered Species Act that saved the bald eagle, House Resource Committee Chairman Richard Pombo from California is crafting loopholes that are a developer's dream. At least, that's the statement that Defenders of Wildlife is making. "We are stunned by just how bad Representative Pombo's draft bill is," said Roger Schleicheson, president of Defenders of Wildlife. "The bill all but eliminates the federal effort to help endangered species and creates a whole new series of loopholes that enable oil companies, large-scale developers, timber companies, mining corporations, and other special interests to dodge the Act's protections. According to critics, the bill is filled with perks for the special interests. These include abandoning the national commitment to bring declining species back from the brink of extinction, sharply diminishing habitat protections for endangered and threatened species. It changes the definition of what constitutes an endangered species, provides giant loopholes that allow legal appeals during every step of the endangered species conservation process, and sets 2015 as the expiration date for the Endangered Species Act. To find out more about these proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act, you are invited to visit the website www.saveesa.org. That's www.saveesa.org. And guess what's been making tracks in one of America's great national parks? Theropods. That's right, those Tyrannosaurus Rex-like wingless birds that were trekking across the Alaskan landscape in Denali National Park 70 million years ago. It came as a bit of a surprise to Susie Tomsich, an undergraduate at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who spotted the track on the underside of a ledge. "Something told me to look around, and I did, and I spotted this one," she said. The ancient footprint itself is not necessarily so unusual as theropod footprints have been noted in Alaska before. But it is the location. All previous theropod prints have been found along the coast. The inland location of this footprint suggests that this dinosaur may have decided he needed to get away for a bit, so decided to visit one of America's national parks for the weekend. And that's the news. Well, visiting a national park for the weekend is now more popular than ever in most national parks. And it's no wonder. With so much to see and learn, And in these complex times, let us always remember and never forget that time spent amongst the wondrous places is the most effective cure for a dull spirit or a tired dream. And that is why this 4th of July week, we want to remind you that you, yes, you own that park that's down the road from you. And you own every national park that you can visit in a day or a week and hopefully for the rest of our lives. Now, I feature national parks on the Wild Side News every few shows. There have been some truly great moments. And today, you are being treated to a national park sampler. So, just in case you can't pack up and visit a national park in the next, couple days, here is a mini inspirational hour of national park moments. We start with a montage of historical notes as told by interpreters from your National Park Service. 96 National Historic Site.
Well, the people were coming literally by the thousands from particularly the British Isles. It was a time in the early 1700s when Britain, France, and Spain all claimed large portions of America, and they were enemies at the time. Those three countries were. The English were very determined. They meant to oust France and Spain from the North American continent. So they were very anxious for their settlers to populate portions of English colonies, including South Carolina. So they made land grants available. The English government did. So many, many people wanted to start new lives, some for religious reasons, and just wanted to, in a sense of adventure. Many families traveled here. And by the 1750s and 1760s, many, many people from the British Isles were coming to live in the back country, which is what this was called, away from the coast of South Carolina. It was called the back country, and many people were coming to live here.
George Washington Memorial Parkway.
Well, George Washington Memorial Parkway is really quite an interesting park in the national park system. It's actually the parkway itself, which is about 32 miles long. It runs mainly in Virginia on the along the Potomac River, and it starts at Mount Vernon and actually goes all the way up to Great Falls of the Potomac, and it goes over into the Maryland side as well, with the sites of Clara Barton's house and the Glen Echo Park, which is actually a turn-of-the-century Chautauqua and amusement park that's been converted into a park area.
Now, actually, the 30-mile journey includes a lot of memorials that people assume are just part of America.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about some of those memorials as well that actually you administer?
We actually manage and take care of Arlington House, which is the ancestral home of the Custis Lee family. For those listeners, that's the individual. It's the home of Robert E. Lee and Martha Custis. And we also take care of the U.S. Marine Corps Memorial, otherwise known as the Iwo Jima Memorial. We have a number of other smaller park areas that probably aren't as well known. We have the LBJ, the Lyndon B. Johnson Memorial Grove. We have the Sailors and Seamen Memorial. All of these are along the Potomac River. Some areas we have Fort Hunt Park. Really, the range of cultural, natural, and recreational areas that we have within that 32-mile stretch is pretty astounding when people start looking at it.
Cane Creole National Historical Park.
The reason why this got national significance is they have managed to preserve not just the main house, which you might expect, but also a lot of the other buildings, the quarters where the enslaved people lived, the blacksmith shop, the pigeon houses, and hundreds of thousands of artifacts. So we're just now discovering what's here and starting to put it together. A visitor walking through the grounds might well notice something that nobody has noticed since the first, you know, perhaps enslaved person built it 150 years ago. It is very much a place of discovery. And I was thinking about how to express the depth of the textures here. And I'm thinking about if you find your way into, say, the North Slave Cabin, and the walls, originally, of course, they're bousiage, it's mud walls covered with cypress. But then on top of that, you've got layers and layers and layers of, we'll call it wallpaper, but it's a mix of cardboard boxes and magazine articles and newspaper and school projects. And just somehow the layering, there's so much obvious living that has gone on here that has not been cleaned up. It's just a very enchanting place. And the natural side, which is the thing to talk about today, is amazing. The pecan trees here, 100 feet high, and the live, I mean, they dwarf the live oaks. Yeah, it's just a very moody, enchanting, intimate plantation.
Sitka National Historical Park.
Again, one of the reasons why Sitka and the park itself are so important historically. In the year 1802, the Russians and the Tlingit had an agreement of sorts, not a very comfortable one, that allowed the Russians to build a settlement up the coast a little ways from today's downtown Sitka. Things went awry. The Tlingit ended up attacking that settlement and sending the Russians out of the area, reclaiming their home. But they knew, the Tlingit knew, that ultimately the Russians would most likely be coming back. And by 1804 had relocated their own settlement to near the mouth of today's Indian River, which is within the park. They built a fortification, and sure enough, the Russians did return. 200 years ago, the Tlingit, in their fortification near the mouth of Indian River, saw the Russian ships returning to the area. They relocated their fort to the mouth of the river for a very good reason. Along the coastline of Baranof Island, the coast is steep, and ships, even large ships, can get relatively very close to the beach. But here at the mouth of the river, the shoals extended quite a ways out into the channel. And by that time, the Tlingit knew the effectiveness of both cannon and musket, and knowing that keeping the ships a distance from the fort was in their best interest, and that's exactly what happened. The Russians saw the fortification, and at some point began firing on it without much effect because of, again, of that strategic positioning. Later on, a landing party approached the fort, led by Alexander Baranof, who was the chief manager for the Russian-American Company, who, again, were hoping to expand the fur trade here. Baranof himself was wounded as that party landed on the beach, and the Tlingit were successful in forcing the party back onto the Russian ships, where they sat and pondered what the next move ought to be.
Harry S. Truman, National Historic Site.
Yes, the home was basically kept the same after his death by Bess Truman. Harry Truman died in 1972, and then she died 10 years later in 1982. And the home was kept exactly the way they lived in it. There was no extravagance there, and you see that when you come in. It's like going, I guess, speaking from my age, it's like going to my grandmother's home and seeing the kitchen and the kitchen stove and the small table with chairs for two against the wall, a calendar there and a little clock and so forth. And then you go into the dining room through the butler, the area where the food was prepared and so forth. And the dining room was kind of interesting, and this is why we have other family members' homes involved with it, because the family ate together. The Wallace family would come over and have their dinners. They would always be dressed up in suits and ties for dinner. And then you walk into the living room and music room, and this is where he would have dignitaries come and visit him. They were never able to pass beyond that point because that was private and his family. But his friends in the neighborhood could always come in the back door. And we keep our group size down to about 8 individuals when they come through. We have no barriers or signs, interpretive signs. So it's as if you are being invited into the Truman home, and you get that personal sense by the small group tour and by having no signs and barriers there that you expect him to come around the corner and greet you.
Wow, that sounds so alive, actually. Is there something that you've come across? I know when you work in national parks, you get the privilege of really becoming very personal with these objects. Is there something that you've come across that stands out as just sort of touched you in some special way?
Well, I think the key thing, and I think it touches almost every person that goes through, is that when you walk into the toward the living room, you look over your left shoulder, and there's a side door there, and there's a coat rack. And on that coat rack is Harry Truman's hat, coat, and cane, and they were left there the last time he took a walk, and Bess Truman never moved them, and they're still there today.
Golden Spike National Monument.
Well, it truly was a great moment in American history. Two railroad companies, the Central Pacific, started in Sacramento, California, and worked their way east. The Union Pacific Railroad Company started in Omaha, Nebraska, and worked their way west. And these two railroad companies just overcame great odds as far as finances, terrain, and finding workers to, you know, complete the construction of the railroad. And finally, in this last burst of enthusiastic effort, they crossed northern Utah and met on May 10, 1869, and actually completed the Transcontinental Railroad 6 years ahead of schedule.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, how many people were at that event?
You know, that's a good question. Reports vary wildly. They vary anywhere between 200 to over 1,000. So it's really difficult to say. There was, you know, a group here that day, but there was so much trouble with reporters being able to hear. Of course, they didn't have sound systems, you know, that sort of thing, that we'll never be quite sure exactly how many people were here in 1869.
On the website, I have images of some of the engines actually as they exist at your site now. They're extremely, I call them extremely brightly colored. We don't usually see engines that are red and blue. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's an interesting story.
It is interesting, and it's one of the things that really draws people to this site. And they always ask us, you know, were these special locomotives that were created for the ceremony in 1869? And no, the two locomotives that were here in 1869, the ones that we have replicas, working replicas of now, they were that brightly colored. And I think it's important for folks to remember what time in America that we're talking about here. We're talking about the Victorian age, the Gilded Age, when there was, it was very important that things be very decorative, and if you had money, you definitely wanted other people to know it. And so that's what these locomotives were a reflection of, and certainly the Transcontinental Railroad was seen as, you know, this crowning achievement for America, and it was also a great advertisement for the railroads. And so it was very typical that locomotives of that time were very, very brightly colored, very highly decorated. And so our replica engines here are a reflection of that time and truly a reflection of the two original locomotives, the Jupiter and the number 119.
There is something for everyone in your national parks. When we return, we give tribute to one of our nation's fascinating historical parks as we head to Baltimore, Maryland, and hear from one of the nation's most inspired interpreters, who adds his voice to the voice of the earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, while the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, when it returned, the birthplace of America's star-spangled banner. In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans and we fought the bloody British in the town of New Orleans. We fired our... You know the song. That's one that I grew up with. That song was just a cute song when I was growing up. But not anymore. It's a musical tribute to a moment in American history that is enshrined in this week's Park of the Week. Fort McHenry is a unique part of our national park system. It's a national monument, but it's also an historic shrine. To take us on a tour of this unique moment, to America's identity, is Vince Vase, park ranger and a terrific interpreter. Vince, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you, Sidney. Glad to be here.
Well, let's begin and let's talk about the setting of Fort McHenry. Where is this place? Where is Fort McHenry?
Fort McHenry is right in Baltimore. Actually, we're on a peninsula known as Locust Point, which is about a mile and a half from what many of the visitors know of as the Inner Harbor.
You know, it's people on the website, on the Wild Side News, take a look because it's an amazing park. I mean, there's some aerial views of this place, and it has a very unique design. Why don't you talk about that, because that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's a star-shaped fort that sits on 43 acres of green space in the outer harbor of Baltimore. The star-shaped basically looks like a pentagon with different bastions coming off of each corner. And that was a pretty common way of building forts. A lot of people say, okay, you built the fort to repulse the British from sea, but the actual star shape is to protect the four walls from a land attack.
That's absolutely right. So when was this constructed and why?
It was constructed, they started really building it in 1798. They finished in 1803. There was a lot of turmoil in the world at that time. Actually, when they were building it, there was some fear that we might get into a war with the French. And then shortly thereafter, our relationship with the French improved, but our relationship with the British declined. So it was part of a large-scale program to build a series of seacoast forts to protect a lot of other major cities. For example, one outside of Philadelphia is called Fort Mifflin. One in New York Harbor has now been filled with concrete, and the Statue of Liberty sits on top of it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the fort itself has kind of a legend as being the birthplace of the Star-Spangled Banner. Now, let's have that story, because that actually is an important part of the significance of and why this is an historic shrine.
Yeah, well, I always say, well, in a way, it's a little bit more than a legend. I mean, it is true. It is the birthplace of the Star-Spangled Banner.
Yeah.
Francis Scott Key, young Georgetown lawyer, was following the events that were going on in the hot summer of 1814. During the War of 1812, the British did invade Maryland. I guess you could say, though, we had it coming. We did invade Canada ourselves. The British then marched on to Washington, D.C., routed an American army, and took the capital. They burnt the government buildings, but they did spare the homes of the common folk. As the British retreated, a local doctor, his name was Dr. William Beans, was tending the wounded, the British wounded, the American wounded, and some of the British soldiers started roughing up his house a little bit, so he took a few of them prisoner. One of those prisoners, though, managed to escape and go back to the British army that was re-embarking on their ships. And pretty much he said that Dr. William Beans was not a gentleman, that indeed he violated his oath not to arrest or molest any British seamen or Royal Marines or Army personnel. The British general staff ordered that man captured. You know, breaking your word was a pretty serious offense in the early 19th century, and so he was arrested. And word spread like wildfire that, in effect, the British had taken a civilian captive. And that was something that was really seldom done at that time. Francis Scott Key, a prominent Georgetown lawyer, believed he could use his powers of persuasion to have Dr. Beans released. So he actually asked the government if he could go along with the American prisoner of war exchange agent, a gentleman by the name of Skinner, to help effect the man's release. And Key was a pretty clever individual. He did more than just tag along. He actually took the time to visit some of the British wounded who were treated by Dr. Beans and actually got letters from these wounded British soldiers saying that Dr. Beans saved a number of their lives, and that he really was a gentleman, and that unjustly taken prisoners. So Key rendezvoused with John Skinner in Baltimore, Maryland. They used a government ship. It was a small, what they call a cartel ship. It was basically a rented merchant ship, unarmed, sailing out of Baltimore on a flag of truce, and about 20 miles down the Patapsco River, down the Chesapeake Bay, they rendezvoused with this vast British armada that was in full sail toward Baltimore. They were wined and dined in the Admiral's cabin on one of the larger warships. Arguments on both sides were presented, and it was actually the letters that swung the argument in favor of Francis Scott Key and John Skinner to have Dr. William Beanes released. There was one proviso, though, in the British Admiralty, and some of the general staff said that they would release Dr. Beanes. However, they were not permitted to return to Baltimore until the British had attacked it. Understandable, I suppose. They didn't want Francis Scott Key and Dr. Beanes relating everything that they had known and seen of the British preparations to attack Baltimore. So in a way, Francis Scott Key had a front row seat. He was on a small, unarmed American ship anchored amongst this British fleet as the bombardment and the invasion of Baltimore began.
Right, and that, let's give it a try here. I may have a recording of the Star Spangled Banner. Let's see if we can pick this up. And we'll play this in the background and then talk about what happened next.
Okay.
In terms of his watching the bombardment and the creation of our Star Spangled Banner.
Very well. The British actually tried to take Baltimore by land. They dropped off 5,000 troops and they started marching up a road known as Long Log Lane. And it's hard to believe if you go there today because it's covered in steel mills and automobile plants. But at the time, it was all trees and farmland. The American militia met them. There was a battle called the Battle of North Point. One of the British generals, General Ross, was killed. And the British pushed back this American advance guard toward the outskirts of the city. And what did they find on the outskirts of the city? Well, the British found that they were outnumbered 3-1. There were over 15,000 American troops dug in on the outskirts of the city.
Wow.
That the actual American people of Baltimore, the Baltimoreans, rallied to dig this massive entrenchment. And to me, the most poignant remembrance was by an eyewitness who actually said that he saw that there were some of the richest citizens of the city working next to free African Americans. He actually said free blacks at the time. There were some slaves, women, children, some working class Baltimoreans all working side by side. So it amounted to really almost a small social revolution if you think about it. This incredible feeling of unity to save a city from a common enemy. Help went out, and there were over 1,000 Pennsylvanians who came down, over 2,000 Virginians, people from western Maryland, Frederick, even as far as Hagerstown, and from the eastern shore of Maryland. And, I mean, we drive this in a few hours, but you can imagine what it took to walk to get there, which is what they did. But the massive entrenchment, all these reinforcements, there was one flaw. And the flaw was the entrenchment ended at the water. It ended at the Patapsco River. And the British figured that out. And they knew that if they could bring their warships up to, in a way, get on the side of that trench, right where it dead-ended on the water, they could turn that trench into a deadly bowling alley. And therefore, on the 13th of September, 16 British ships came up the Patapsco River to take on Fort McHenry. If they could destroy the fort, they could easily get into the inner harbor, get past the trench, and take care of the city of Baltimore. And I think reflecting the attitudes of the British, I mean, we have letters. I mean, these things were written down. One British captain, a Captain Codrington, actually said, he predicted, there will be many busted heads in Baltimore before nightfall. And I think that shows the attitude of at least some of the British officers involved in this. The British ships got within range of the fort's guns. One eyewitness said it sounded like thunder when the fort's cannons fired. They were fired in such rapid succession.
Wow.
And the Baltimoreans went on the rooftops. We have a lot of letters, people saying that they were on the roof of the Holiday Street Theater, which is today City Hall. We also have letters of other people squirming out, you know, and climbing on the rooftops. And they said you could see the smoke curling up over the fort and the flashes of the fort's guns in the midst of the smoke.
Vince?
And, yeah.
Boy, do you like your work?
Just a little bit. No, I love my work.
I know, it's so obvious.
I love my work.
You're a fabulous interpreter. And we didn't even have a chance to really talk about the rest of the park, but I'll tell you what, Vince is the best invitation to visit Fort McHenry in Maryland that I can imagine. Thanks, Vince, for being here and sharing your story.
No, you're welcome indeed.
Okay.
There are so many wonderful parks to visit, so we continue our celebration of America's national parks as we head on down to Big Bend National Park and more when we return on Your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Ever noticed how time alone, a little space, a slower pace, and things kind of sort themselves out? Well, add some spectacular scenery, tons of birds and cougars, bears, and a legendary old river, and you've got the makings of a powerful good time. Find out about one of America's finest national parks, where all this is yours every day of the year. When we return, here on the Wild Side News. Let's say you wanted to get away and think about the earth, do a little digging for meaning, touching nature, letting nature touch you. We all need to reconnect to the deeper meaning of life. Our National Park of the Week is a place for you to wander to. It's a place for the writers and thinkers, nature people, and explorers to come. Big Bend National Park sits up against the Rio Grande River, a river of great power and legend. To help us discover this somewhat obscure but legendary wonder is Big Bend's Chief of Interpretation, David Elkowitz. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start out with a little bit of a weather report. Give people a sense of how life is down there right now.
Well, it really varies with where you are here in the park. The park has elevations ranging from about 2,000 to almost 8,000. So at the low elevations, probably in the 90s, sunny. Really pretty day in the mountains, probably in the low 80s, and just beautiful. Great for hiking.
Well, you know, that's going to be part of the theme of this discussion about Big Bend, because this variation in altitude and, of course, the weather is a big part of why this park is so exciting. So give us a fix on the location of Big Bend National Park.
Well, Big Bend is in southwest Texas. It is right along the Rio Grande, as you said, the river of legend and fable, and still a river today used for people that like to raft and or canoe. Big Bend is reasonably remote, but is accessible by airport and car, and many people do find their way here and stay for days at a time because there's so much to do.
Well, my take on the park is that it's a tribute to the diversity of the Southwest. So let's take a look at some of that diversity. Let's start with some of the natural features. It really, by the way, I encourage listeners to go to the website, Wildside News, and look at today's webpage for this segment, because you'll be amazed. So let's talk about that.
The diversity of the park is just amazing, whatever way you want to look at it, whether you look at it from a geology or paleontology or history standpoint. We have the romantic history of the West and the border culture, which are both are unique and wonderful. But in terms of natural history is one of the main reasons the park was set aside. tremendous numbers of birds, over 450, over 75 species of mammals, including, like you said in your introduction, cougars, bears, deer, bighorn sheep, and other types of large mammals, lots of reptiles, amphibians, and over 1,200 species of plants. Even though this is largely considered desert, it is very green and very diverse much of the year.
Well, it's not just desert, too. Let's start going up the hill here now, because you start with the river. That's probably the low point in the park, I suppose.
The river is the low point in the park. Elevations there are 1,800 to about 2,000 above sea level. Okay. And there's a green corridor along the river, ducks and waterfowl of all kinds and turtles and you name it, beaver and such. From there you go out across the Chuaoyan Desert, which is the wettest of the deserts, and thus it is full of mesas and a lot of what people associate with the Wild West or cowboy movies, but it's relatively very green and very diverse in terms of having a lot of plants. From there you go up into the Chisos Mountains. It is a wholly different place. At 5,400 feet and going up to almost 8,000 feet, there's forests, trees, great diversity of life, springs, just a great place to hike or camp.
It's an absolutely gorgeous landscape there with the red rocks and the buttes, the river, and also the sky, of course, in the southwest is one of the miraculous realities there.
Absolutely. We have among the best night skies to be found anywhere in the continental U.S., and actually a lot of people come here just for stargazing. People from areas where there's a lot of light aren't just flabbergasted by the number of stars at night here.
Well, you know, let's talk about some of the opportunities for people to visit the park. In other words, you know, there's camping and hiking, and well, let's talk about some of the options for recreation there.
The options are almost limitless. In terms of camping, we have all different kinds, regular family camping and campgrounds with picnic tables and bathrooms. Backcountry camping you can drive to with a car or a four-wheel drive and be out by yourself. Backpacking of all types and sizes, river rafting and camping on the river for multi-night trips. We do have a hotel in the park. The hotel offers modern accommodations, a restaurant. It's up in the basin where it's just beautiful in the evenings. It's very pleasant. So your options are many. And there's also a number of options on the western side and northern side of the park in terms of hotels and camping as well.
Again, diversity seems to be the theme. It is an amazing park when you really get to know the place, and I'm going to encourage everybody to take a serious look at Big Bend National Park. I think one of the amazing things about the park in terms of a quality visit is the fact that there aren't millions of people there.
That is one of the unique things. Given the fact that this is one of the largest parks in the country, the remoteness is what really makes it unique. 350,000 visitors a year is the average here, as opposed to a park that would be closer to major highways, which might get in the millions, and thus at least the easy-to-get-to areas would be more crowded. This park has just wonderful opportunities for solitude and getting away from it.
For me, that would be one of the grandest aspects of a visit to Big Bend, and I have been there, and that is exactly the feeling. You have an opportunity to reconnect with stuff that's hard to find anymore, quite honestly, living in the modern age, and you can find those values and those experiences at Big Bend. It's an amazing place.
It really is, and we have a very faithful following of visitors. Many people that come here will spend at least 3 to 4 nights and will come back year after year. Thus, this is a destination more than a stop, in my opinion. There's plenty to do here for a week's vacation.
Well, now, of course, now the birding is a large attraction there. Let's talk about the incredible diversity of bird species you have.
Birding is certainly one of our big draws in that some types of birds cannot be found anywhere else in the United States except here. The best example of that is the Colima warbler. It's a Mexican species of bird, and the only known place in the continental U.S. or any part of the U.S. is the Chisos Mountains in the center of the park if you wish to see this bird in the United States. But there's tons of other types of birds to see, everything from rare hawks like blackhawks and greyhawks to hummingbirds of all kinds to lots of buntings and lots of other types of birds, vireos, warblers, and such.
So bring a good field guide and a pair of binoculars.
You bet.
Yeah. And let's talk about some of the big species, too, some of your grand predators.
We have most of the grand predators that should be here, including mountain lion. They're the top of the food chain. And there's a couple of dozen mountain lion that live year-round in the park and are quite healthy. They eat deer and javelina and are critical to their population's health. We have bear, black bear, other big predators, bobcat, coyote as well.
Yeah, and I, you know,
and you have an opportunity to see these. You will if you spend time there, particularly if you head out in the mornings and the evenings, you're more likely to see some of these creatures than at other times. And that all by itself is magic, because it's something that a lot of people never have an opportunity to experience. You know, I visited there. I was living in Santa Fe. I came down there in the winter because it was an opportunity to kind of get away from the snow and the cold. And, by you know, that's exactly what happened. So you're kind of known as a winter park. But, you know, from what I understand, that attitude is changing about Big Bend. Let's talk about that.
That really is an interesting part of Big Bend. Big Bend is largely known as a winter park because we have very warm temperatures, relatively speaking, in the wintertime at the low elevations. But people forget that the high country, the mountains, are quite cool relatively in the summer. Normally in the 80s, well-shaded trails for hiking and backpacking. It's a great time to visit in the summertime because you have the trails almost entirely to yourself, and they're beautiful.
I think also you don't have the humidity. Am I right about that?
You sure are. We have very low humidity here relatively, and it's really comfortable that way in terms of even on warmer days, it's dry.
And, of course, that cuts down on the bugs and things like that, which is a blessing if you're outdoors a lot. That can be kind of irritating.
It sure is. We have few bugs,
also,
relatively speaking.
Yeah, relatively speaking, I understand. But I grew up in Minnesota. Enough said. So, also, you're doing a variety of rather interesting interpretive programming. Let's talk about some of the events that people can experience when they come to your park.
That is another nice thing about Big Bend, and the fact that we have a number of people that stay overnight, campgrounds, hotels, and such. We run programs or interpretive programs and such pretty much every day, 365 days of the year, sometimes several programs a day, and they vary. They vary from hikes to walks to evening slide programs, and they're great opportunities to get out and experience Big Bend. We do a lot of birding programs. We do programs on the history, the geology. We do hiking. You name it. There are different opportunities throughout the year to learn about this resource.
And do you offer that programming year-round?
We do.
See, that's kind of unique because a lot of parks don't really do that.
A lot of parks are limited to weekends or holidays just because that's when the people are there. But with us, it's every day that people are here, and so we run programs every day.
And I also understand that you're doing some nighttime programming as well.
We are. We're doing some star programs among our other nighttime opportunities. We also typically do an evening program, which will be an amphitheater program with a ranger, kind of like the old-time fire programs, except we do ours without a fire, but in the amphitheater at night, slides and or PowerPoint.
You know, about the only thing missing is an ocean. I mean, you've got beauty, you've got solitude, you have open spaces, you have an opportunity for people to connect in ways that they probably can't in many other areas. You offer excellent camping, a diversity of bird species, wild animals, great programming. What's missing?
There really isn't anything missing, in my opinion. It's just a great place to be, and it's a great place to spend time and connect.
Tell us how our listeners can find your website.
That's easy. Go to the National Park Service site, which is www.nps, which stands for National Park Service, .gov. And from there, just select Big Bend among the list of parks.
Thanks, David Elkowitz, Chief of Interpretation, Big Bend, for being on the Wild Side News.
If you want to hear more about your national parks, visit the Wild Side News archives, where you'll find a great collection of past immersions into your national park system. And of course, you can always find out all you need to know about a national park visit by visiting the national park website at www.nps.gov. So, until we meet again, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios and inviting you to tune in each Thursday or any day or time on the Wild Side News Archives, on your Voice of the Earth, here on the Wild Side News.